resources are getting better all the time, and more treasure is being discovered. It is, of course, possible that much of it is not being reported. Luckily, the 1996 Treasure Act does provide an incentive for amateurs and enthusiasts to report their finds. It guarantees an impartial valuation and opens the door to above-board purchases from institutions with a mission to preserve and curate Britain's past. And surely, on the balance, it's much better to find than not find these hoards, which have the collective effect of giving us a better understanding of material culture in Anglo-Saxon and Viking Britain.
Lecture 5, Britain's Medieval Castles.
Prehistoric, Roman and Anglo-Saxon vestiges are widespread in Britain. But you need to know a lot of history and something about archaeology to work out what's what. It gets much easier after the Norman invasion of 1066, because there are so many big, impressive medieval buildings in Britain. The castles and the cathedrals are the most striking of all, bearing witness to the era's two great obsessions, war and Christianity. There are hundreds of buildings in Britain whose names include the word castle. But beware of the word. Some of them are earthworks, like Maiden Castle in Dorset, with nothing visible above ground level. Others are 19th century sham castles, like Ryber Castle in Derbyshire, which was built in 1862 by industrialist John Smedley. Smedley liked the idea of living in a medieval castle, and so he had one built to order, though the local people, who called it Smedley's Folly, were evidently unimpressed. Castle Drogo in Devonshire looks even older, but is actually even younger, started in 1910 and not finished until about 1930. Eilley and Donan in Scotland, which could compete strongly for the prize of most scenically impressive castle in the world, was built around a few ancient fragments in the 1920s and early 1930s. These examples remind us that for the last 200 years at least, castles have stimulated the romantic imagination and tempted generations of rich men to build their own. In this lecture, however, I want to concentrate on actual medieval castles built between 1066 and 1500 for military, not scenic, reasons. William the Conqueror used castles right from the outset to assert his authority and create strong points in his new kingdom. The earliest were Mott and Bailey castles, in which a wooden keep or stronghold was set up on a mound or mott, sometimes man-made. An area around the motte, known as the bailey, would be fenced in with a stout palisade and contain barracks, stables, a well, a chapel, storehouses, and the other necessities of a garrison. Ideally, a ditch or moat outside the palisade would create added difficulties for potential attackers. No such wooden castles survive, but Britain still has several in which the original wooden keep was later replaced by a stone keep. At Cardiff Castle, for example, in the grounds of a much later building, stands the circular mott with a strong stone tower or shell keep on top. The next stage in castle design was the square stone keep. Several built in the 1100s survive, including those at Dover, Orford, and the Tower of London. The tower, begun in 1070, is almost a cube, 107 by 118 feet at the base and 90 feet tall. As the historian Mark Morris says, construction on this scale had not been witnessed in Britain since the time of the Romans. The Normans were well aware of this and seem to have been deliberately styling themselves as new Romans come a-conquering in imperial style. The walls of these stone towers are often 10 feet thick, meaning that they feel oddly smaller inside than they look from outside. The benefit, of course, was that no siege engine could knock down a structure so immensely strong. The armies of the day lacked explosives to destroy them. Only by tunneling beneath it was it sometimes possible to provoke a cave-in that might partially destroy such a keep. The logical next step was to build an outer wall, or curtain wall, around the keep, making it all the more difficult for attackers even to approach it. This development is visible in many of the great fortifications of the 1200s. The Tower of London, for example, was made safer and stronger by having the keep enclosed by an outer wall during the reign of King Henry III. When a second wall outside that one was added by his son Edward I, it became stronger still. The tower is one of many places where you can see the development of these stages and where, in general, the outer layers are more recent than the inner. The superiority of multiple defensive layers led to the development of concentric castles designed from the outset to present attackers with a succession of obstacles to overcome, and making it likely that any who broke through the first ring would be subjected to devastating fire from the second. Concentric castles also included refinements, such as towers bulging out from the line of the curtain wall, so that attackers would never find shelter from defenders' fire. Probably the greatest concentric castle in Britain is at Caerphilly in Wales. It was built not by the king, but by an extremely powerful baron, Gilbert de Clare, struggling in the 1270s to assert his power against the Welsh rebel Llywelyn ap Gruffydd. Not only does it have a concentric design, it's further secured by sitting in the midst of an artificial lake, making it difficult even to approach. A causeway across one of the two dams that created the lake could be heavily defended. By the time it was finished, however, Wales lay securely in English hands, so the castle was never put to the test. A distinctive aspect of Caerphilly is that one of its towers stands at a crooked angle far off the vertical. It was probably blown up during the English Civil War, but we have no documentation to prove it. In any case, Caerphilly, just a few miles north of Cardiff, is superb. The historian Patrick Cormack describes it as, quite simply, one of the greatest buildings of the Middle Ages, equal in importance to any of Britain's major cathedrals. There never was a more triumphant assertion of power and magnificence by any noble subject. Refinements of various kinds are also apparent in concentric castle designs. Because the gatehouse was a potential weak point, with wooden gates more vulnerable to battering rams than walls, they might be protected by being approached over a drawbridge that could be hoisted in times of danger. Similarly, a portcullis, a thick iron-banded gate that descended from above, added strength to gateways. Murder holes overhead, through which hot liquids, rocks, and fire could be thrown down on attackers, are common in these gatehouses, though I've never found a reference to boiling oil being used, except in fiction. Edward I was England's castle builder par excellence. He consolidated his grip on Wales in the 1280s and 1290s by building four massive ones, Conwy, Carnarvon, Harlech and Beaumaris. They were built for strength to overawe Welsh onlookers, to assert Edward's claim to the throne, and to provide him with places to live safely and comfortably while he was in the area. His architect, James of St. George, came from Savoy, the area of the Western Alps where France, Italy and Switzerland meet. Edward honoured him with high pay and generous estates. Carnarvon's walls are made of different coloured banded stones. This is an echo of the walls of Constantinople, the Byzantine capital, which Edward had visited when he went on crusade. He cited Carnarvon at the place where the Romans had established their local headquarters, Saguntum. In both these ways, Edward was not merely building a stronghold, he was also implying a continuity between the old Roman overlords and himself as the new one. In the days when castles were useful to the degree that they could be defended, it's worth asking how successful they were in resisting sieges and safeguarding their defenders. The answer is that they worked well so long as the defenders were resolute and well-led, and so long as they had supplies of food and fresh water. Poor leadership, famine, epidemics and internal treason could all provoke failure among defenders. Harlech, for example, garrisoned by only 37 men, withstood an entire Welsh army besieging it in 1294. Harlech also held out for 7 years in the 1460s as a stronghold for the Lancastrian side in the Wars of the Roses, though admittedly it wasn't under continuous threat. When you visit Harlech today, you find it about a mile inland, with the sea visible in the middle distance across an open plain. When it was built, by contrast, the castle was actually on the coast and could be resupplied by sea. Most of Britain's castles are ruins today, and for nearly 3 centuries, owners and visitors have enjoyed seeing them in that state. The romantic appeal of a ruined castle matches the romantic appeal of a ruined monastery. Some are ruins simply because no one looked after them after their original military functions ceased. Many more, however, are in ruins because they were deliberately wrecked or slighted, sometimes in the reign of Henry VIII, the king who abolished private armies, but most of all at the end of the Civil War in the 1640s. The parliamentary armies of Thomas Fairfax and Oliver Cromwell devoted a lot of energy to besieging royalist-held castles and wanted to make sure, after the fighting ended, that they would never have to do so again. Slighting consisted of damaging them badly enough to make their restoration impossibly expensive, especially for royalists who were forced to pay heavy fines for having been on the wrong side. Castles that are not ruins today are well preserved either because they were converted into aristocratic dwellings or because regiments of the British Army continue to use them as military bases. Edinburgh and Dover castles, for example, were working military bases until the 1920s and 1950s respectively, before being turned into full-time visitor attractions. In fact, part of Edinburgh is still in use by the army and off-limits to visitors. Warwick, Bamburgh and Cardiff were turned from ruins into residences by wealthy families, inspired by the idea of living in medieval surroundings. It would be easy to do a dozen lectures on Britain's castles, and I will return to many important ones, such as Conwy and Edinburgh, when we tour the various regions of Britain. For the rest of today, however, let me suggest 4 castles that are particularly fascinating to visit. Bamburgh in the north, Dover in the south, Warwick in the Midlands, and finally, the most famous of the lot, the Tower of London. First, Bamburgh is phenomenal. Just a few miles south of the Scottish border and perched on high ground overlooking the North Sea, it has a magnificently romantic profile. Founded by the Normans on the site of a much older fort, it was besieged by King William II in 1095 when its owner, Robert de Mowbray, rebelled. Robert was captured, but his doughty wife refused to surrender and the royal army could not break down the defences. The king finally told her that Robert would have his eyes torn out if she did not surrender, at which point she relented. After many years of resisting Scottish raids and enduring another siege during the Wars of the Roses, Bamburgh fell into decay. Partially restored as an asylum, a girls' school, and a hostel for shipwrecked sailors, the castle was bought by William Armstrong in 1894 and restored to more than its former glory. Armstrong was an engineer and munitions manufacturer, one of Britain's most successful businessmen in the late 19th century, whose other house, Cragside, was the first dwelling in the world to be lighted by hydroelectric power. Armstrong created a medieval fantasy world inside Bamburgh. The Great Hall features a hammer beam roof. Life-size portraits and ancient weapons decorate the high walls above the ground-level wooden panelling. High windows admit light through the immensely thick outer walls. Porcelain vases and great globes complete the decoration. Another barrel-vaulted room is given over entirely to a collection of arms and armour. The succeeding rooms are decorated with comparable lavishness. On the battlements, great old cannons face out toward the North Sea below. Armstrong died before the renovation could be completed, but his successors held on to the castle right up to the present. In one of the annexes stands a museum of the weapons he designed and built. One of the biggest castles in Britain is at Dover, and it is also one of the best to visit. It sits atop the White Cliffs, where the English Channel is at its narrowest, and looks superb if you're approaching England on a cross-channel ferry from France. The town of Dover is unremarkable, but take the steep hill that zigzags out of town, and you'll soon be on the cliff tops. Every generation has added new elements to Dover Castle, but the boldest and strongest medieval parts still stand out clearly. The high central stone keep, the Great Tower, comes from the reign of Henry II and was built in the 1180s. It is now displayed by its owners, English Heritage, as if for a king's visit. Inside on the ground floor, the medieval kitchens are littered with pots, jars, trestle tables and vats suitable to the era. Upstairs, in the royal reception rooms, are banquet tables laid out for the king and his men, whose banners are displayed on the walls. Above that is the throne room, a great stone chamber adorned in rich red fabric, as it might have looked when the king held court there. Beside it is the king's private chapel, elaborately decorated and with its own miniature stained glass window. The walls are 20 feet thick in places. Several mural rooms are contained within the walls, and two spiral staircases run from top to bottom of the tower. A 300-foot well was sunk in the 1180s, which confirms that the castle was designed to withstand siege if necessary. In the event it was necessary, in 1216, the rebellious English nobles, who had just forced King John to sign Magna Carta, invited Prince Louis of France to become their king. He quickly seized most of the southern towns and besieged Dover Castle. His men undermined one of the great stone gatehouses, which crashed to the ground, but the defenders were able to plug the breach with heavy beams stripped from inside the keep. These defenders, led by a resolute Hubert de Burgh and 140 knights, were well supplied. Lewis's siege engines flung rocks and fireballs against the keep, but couldn't make even a dent in such thick walls. In the end, after 3 months' fruitless fighting, Lewis was forced to call a truce, and the besieged garrison survived. Lewis tried again the following year, this time with a great trebuchet named Malvoisin, but still could not break down the walls. Harassed by English guerrillas outside the castle, his siege failed again after only 10 days. At nearby Rochester Castle, the previous year, King John had been the attacker, and one of the rebels its defender. The outcome was the same. The attacker couldn't get in. The closest King John came was when his men tunnelled under one of the towers, keeping up the roof of his tunnels with great wooden props. They then lit a fire using the fat from 40 pigs to make it burn hot, destroy the props, and cause the castle to cave in. Down came the tower, sure enough. But that wasn't enough to get John's army inside the keep. The defenders retreated behind a stout dividing wall and carried on fighting. Only when they were starving after 2 more months did they finally give up. Since we're on the subject, let me say a word about the siege engines used to attack castles. Trebuchets, like Malvoisin, have a great wooden arm, spring-loaded and attached to a sling. When properly primed, it can fling a rock or a ball of burning material a couple of 100 yards with a maximum speed of 150 miles per hour. The ballista is a giant crossbow, while the mangonel is a huge catapult. Siege towers are wooden structures on wheels designed to be rolled up to the enemy battlements and from which attackers can jump onto the walls or fire arrows from just above. Battering rams, sometimes roofed over for their users' protection, are designed to break down gateways. All were tried until the arrival in Western Europe of gunpowder in the early 1300s, after which siege cannons began to displace them. The two elements older than the keep at Dover are the Anglo-Saxon church and, right beside it, the Roman-era lighthouse. The maze of other fortifications all around you mark modifications made to Dover Castle through the centuries as offensive weapons became more powerful and the defenders were forced to adapt. These later additions include 17th century star-shaped abutments and massive earthworks from the First World War era to absorb the impact of incoming naval shells. Beneath the castle, there's a honeycomb of passages and chambers, which have also done different duties through the ages. At one point, they were a prison for French soldiers and sailors captured during the Napoleonic Wars. Later, they became a wartime hospital, where underground operating rooms provided safety against potential aerial attack. Dover's most critical moment in modern times came in May 1940, when the Nazi Blitzkrieg had forced the British Army in France into a headlong retreat to Dunkirk. From these tunnels under Dover Castle, Admiral Bertram Ramsay masterminded their evacuation. There's a statue of him on site. His command post can still be seen, stark and businesslike. The operation involved thousands of volunteers, private boat owners who crossed the channel at great risk to their lives to help get stranded soldiers off the beaches of France and onto deep draft vessels offshore. The unexpected success of this venture, rescuing 330,000 men, led to exaggerated British claims of victory. That in turn prompted the new Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, to issue in Parliament the dry reminder, wars are not won by evacuations. The last use of Dover's tunnels, before becoming a visitor attraction, was as one of the 12 potential seats of government in the event of a nuclear war. Filled with provisions after the Cuba Missile Crisis of 1962, the tunnels were finally decommissioned in the mid-1980s. Warwick Castle is another great crowd pleaser. Right in the heart of the kingdom, it looks like a child's drawing of a medieval castle. Like so many others, it started as an ancient defensive site on which a Norman Mott and Bailey castle was built by William the Conqueror. The Mott is now called Ethelfleda's Mound. Extensive fortifications were added in the 1300s and 1400s. There's a great high rout around the walls and battlements whose highest point, Guy's Tower, is vertigo-inducing. You can look through the murder holes over the gateway next to the workings of the portcullis, and you can visit the dungeons where unfortunate prisoners languished. Warwick was held by a parliamentarian loyalist in the Civil War and successfully withstood a royalist siege. After the restoration, it was turned into a stately home and was never subsequently put to military uses. Warwick has an immense collection of arms and armour. Last time I was there, an eloquent guide explained that the most elaborately worked suits of armour were worn only on ceremonial occasions, rather than for battle. He also distinguished the different ways in which the many weapons on display were supposed to be used. They included various hacking, chopping and spearing motions, all lethal. The best items on display are a suit of horse armour and the armour worn on ceremonial occasions by a teenage boy, possibly the young prince who later became King Charles II. Warwick, still in private hands, rather than being run by the National Trust or English Heritage, has not kept itself immune from commercialisation. There are wax figures of famous residents and visitors provided by Madame Tussauds, lusty wenches in coloured tents, hawk ale, tell bawdy tales and sell tickets to the jousts that are held on summer afternoons. Demonic laughter and shrieks of horror issue from the dungeons. A bird of prey show has eagles and condors swooping overhead to astonish the children. There's more than a hint of Disney about the presentation, especially during the school holidays. Whether that's a good or a bad thing is a matter of taste. I've been there often with groups of American teenagers, nearly all of whom have lapped it up enthusiastically and uncritically, which confirms their suspicion that I might be a bit stuffy. I must also speak up in favour of the great trebuchet, which is demonstrated every day in summer. Moving south, let's return to the Tower of London. Great black ravens hop about the battlements and lawns at the tower. According to tradition, if they ever leave, the kingdom will fall. Several million visitors each year make the tower the single most popular tourist attraction in the whole of Britain. Be prepared for the crowds, but go anyway. If you thought far enough ahead, you can book tickets to the Ceremony of the Keys, which officially closes the tower every evening at 10 o'clock, At the ceremony, one of the red-garbed beef-eaters advances, accompanied by soldiers. A sentry, also in red dress uniform, shouts, "Halt! Who comes there?" The beef-eater or yeoman warder replies, "The keys." "Whose keys?" "Queen Elizabeth's keys." "Pass then, all's well." A full history of the Tower could constitute a pretty good history of England itself over the last millennium, with an emphasis on its more violent elements. It was a royal residence until the 1600s, often an arsenal, a mint where the national coinage was made, a safe house for the storage of the crown jewels, a zoo, the royal menagerie, but above all, a prison. Most of London's Jews were imprisoned there in 1278 on trumped-up charges of degrading the currency. Edward I then expelled the whole Jewish community from England in 1290. A crisis came during the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, menacing the young king, Richard II. A great mob surged into the Tower, stole as many of the jewels as they could find, seized Simon Sudbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had taken shelter in the chapel, and chopped off his head. Here at the Tower were killed the two young princes in the Tower, Edward V and his brother Richard, Duke of York, by King Richard III in 1483. See Shakespeare's Richard III for a dramatic reenactment. But don't forget the offsetting claims of Richard's champions, who say he didn't do it. Here too were imprisoned and killed King Henry VI and two of Henry VIII's wives, Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard. Also, Henry VIII's former minister, Thomas More, an event superbly fictionalised in Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel. Also, Lady Jane Grey, only 17 years old, who briefly asserted a claim to the throne in 1553 before being ousted by Mary I. Also, Sir Walter Raleigh, who spent long enough in prison between arrest and execution to be able to write a history of the world. There is some elaborate graffiti, much of it 300 and 400 years old, on the walls of the old prison chambers, now carefully preserved. 60 people are buried in the grounds of St. Peter ad Vincula, the church inside the Tower grounds. 51 of them were beheaded. On a brighter note, some of the Tower's prisoners went on to successful later lives. Elizabeth I is one notable example. Visitors have been coming to the Tower since the mid-1500s. By now, it's almost entirely a tourist attraction. There's a lot to see. First of all, the buildings themselves, but also exhibits on the Tower's history, the unequalled armoury, and the splendidly attired beef-eaters, all of them veterans of the British military with at least 22 years' service and a good conduct medal. Above all other attractions rank the crown jewels, 141 crowns, maces, scepters, orbs, coronets, and other jewelled objects still used in royal ceremonies, such as the coronation, and the annual state opening of Parliament. One of them, the Sword of Mercy, was made in 1626 for the coronation of King Charles I, and has been used at every coronation since then. Visitors are conveyed by a moving walkway deep in the vaults to view these precious items. The surroundings immediately emphasise their rarity, value and symbolic significance to the nation. In this lecture, I've mentioned just a few of the best castles in Britain, but I want to emphasise that there are hundreds more, some still in good condition, others in fragments and ruins. Around most of them cluster legends and haunting tales of the knights who died defending them, along with true stories of bravery, treachery, and hardship. They are awe-inspiring, not least because of the scale they achieved in an age when most buildings were low wooden shacks or wattle and daub huts. Their high watchtowers can still induce vertigo, even though we're accustomed to multi-story buildings. How much more impressive must they have seemed to the soldiers who manned them, and how much more daunting to the men who were ordered to attack them? Along with the cathedrals, to which we will turn next, they're the most distinctive and instructive relics of medieval Britain.
Lecture 6. Britain's Medieval Cathedrals.
Britain's 26 medieval cathedrals are among its most famous buildings. Many are approaching or have celebrated their 1,000th birthdays. Elegant, majestic and massive, they bear witness to their founders' determination to build something that would last for generations. Even today, they shame nearly every other building around them. Think how much more spectacular they must have been in an age when most people lived and died in thatched huts or squat stone cottages. Something strange has happened to the cathedrals over the last century. They've become less and less places of worship, more and more tourist venues. The most popular, including Westminster Abbey, York Minster, and Canterbury Cathedral, are emptiest during the religious services that were the rationale for their creation. The advantage of this change in fortune is that they will survive. Visitors' money pours in, enabling their caretakers to repair the roof, shore up sagging beams, and repoint the stonework. Their poor country cousins, England's thousands of medieval parish churches, are in far greater danger of neglect and decay because they are so numerous and so needy. The downside of the famous cathedral's popularity is that they're now hard to visit except as part of a crowd, especially during the summer when immense numbers of visitors from all over the world surge through by the thousands. More than 1 million people visit Westminster Abbey every year. If you can possibly do so, visit a few of the provincial cathedrals, which still tower over their surroundings as they did centuries ago, and which can still be seen in quietness and solemnity. Among my favourites are Durham, Lichfield, Wells and Llandaff, where relative quiet still reigns at most times of the year. Around each of these provincial cathedrals stands a cluster of almshouses and old administrative buildings set in beautifully kept grounds that are known collectively as the Close. America is proud of the First Amendment that separates church and state. Most Britons, for centuries, by contrast, assumed the rightness of church-state unification. The Church of England, or C of E, has sordid origins in the divorce politics of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, and has been trying to make up for it ever since. Anglicans speak of the beauty of holiness, the distinctive mood mixing faith and aesthetics that the cathedrals generate. Anthony Trollope uses the idea brilliantly in his series of novels, The Barchester Chronicles, about the lives and tribulations of Victorian-era clergymen. In the first book of the series, The Warden, about a decent man who profits from a corrupt institution under threat of radical reform, he wrote, "Who would not feel charity for a prebendary when walking the quiet length of that long aisle at Winchester, looking at those decent houses, that trim grass plat, and feeling as one must the solemn, orderly comfort of the spot? Who could be hard upon a dean while wandering around the sweet close of Hereford and owning that in that precinct, tone and colour, design and form, solemn tower and storied window are all in unison and all perfect? Who could lie basking in the cloisters of Salisbury and gaze on Jewell's library and that unequalled spire without feeling that bishops should sometimes be rich?" As always with Trollope, there's a mischievous gleam in his eye. He knows how to say one thing while implying its opposite. And the book's dramatic tension comes from his placing the morally justified yet joyless characters against the morally indefensible yet lovable traditionalists. Cathedrals stand at the centre of dioceses, the administrative districts of the Church of England. Each diocese has a bishop. Canterbury and York, the most senior, have archbishops. A cathedra is a bishop's throne. The dean is the clergyman who takes care of the daily and weekly services at the cathedral itself and is usually assisted by a crowd of subordinate clergy. The bishop, by contrast, has responsibility for all the churches and all the clergy in the diocese and spends much of his time travelling among them. Until quite recently, bishops also held seats in the House of Lords. The English cathedrals have a superb musical tradition, and to many of them are attached choir schools, where young boys and girls with treble voices sing the liturgy every day. The choir schools have preserved distinctive ways of singing the communion service every Sunday. Evensong, late each afternoon, and a repertoire of chanted psalms, hymns, and anthems. Just as it's easy to think of cathedrals more as works of art than as houses of prayer, so it's easy to think of their choirs as the providers of concerts rather than worship. The Church of England is at its best architecturally and musically. Its theology and its sermons are far less impressive. These are the pros and cons of having a state church. The earliest medieval cathedrals were built in the Norman or Romanesque style, with heavy columns supporting great rounded arches. They generate a feeling of dark, massive solemnity. The usual plan was a cross shape, with a long nave at the western end, a shorter but elevated chancel at the east, culminating in the altar, with north and south transepts, all four elements meeting at the crossing. Running the length of a Romanesque nave, you'll typically find three series of arches. At the base is the arcade, which defines the nave. Above this is a second set of arches called the triforium, and above the triforium is yet a third set of arches called the clerestory or clerestory, whose pillars lead up to the ribbed or vaulted ceiling. To each side of the nave run aisles, sometimes featuring chapels or side altars. Outside, towers mark the western entrance, which often has an elaborately carved doorway or tympanum. Durham Cathedral in northeast England is perhaps the best example of the Norman style in Britain. Dedicated to St. Cuthbert and begun in 1093, the cathedral occupies a dramatic and strategic hilltop site above the River Weir. For centuries, the bishop had military as well as religious authority, living as he did in territory that was continuously raided by border bandits, the Rivers, and Scottish plunderers. Inside, along the nave, its massive stone columns are decorated with strong yet simple designs of crisscrossing lines and zigzags. Great stained glass windows tell stories either biblical or of the saints, abbots, and warrior chieftains who founded and defended Durham. St. Cuthbert was a monk of Lindisfarne who died in 687, already an ancient memory by the time the current cathedral was founded, on the site of an even older church. It housed his relics and became a pilgrimage site until the Reformation. Durham was a monastic foundation, and a superb set of cloisters adjoins the cathedral. Cloisters are the covered walkways in which the monks would exercise and are a feature of many of the great cathedrals. In the 12th century, the Gothic style began to displace Romanesque or Norman. Architects accepted the challenge of creating a sense of vertical soaring with spaces much higher than they were wide, leading the eye up to remote vaulted ceilings and pointed arches. They also accepted the challenge of making their interiors as light as possible, altering the glass-to-masonry ratio without compromising their structural integrity. The most distinctive features of Gothic cathedrals are wide, bright windows with elaborate tracery, brilliantly coloured stained glass, flying buttresses, spires and pinnacles, all of which seem fanciful, yet each of which contributes to their structure's stability and aesthetic completeness. Unfortunately, hardly any of the medieval stained glass remains. Even where it does, as at York, it has faded from its former glory. The best and most brilliant stained glass in English cathedrals today is mainly Victorian, from the mid and late 19th century. It comes as something of a shock to realise that we don't know the names of the great Gothic cathedrals' architects. Living as we do in an age that celebrates exceptional creative individuals, we look back 700 or 800 years to a world in which the designers and master builders had less opportunity to single themselves out. It's important to remember, besides, that building a cathedral by hand was a project that could easily take 100 years or more. Several of the most famous were clearly redesigned during building, so that their lower sections exhibit different architectural styles than the later, higher sections. At Norwich Cathedral, for example, begun in the same era as Durham, in the Norman style, the upper levels of the chancel have pointed Gothic windows and fine window tracery, demonstrating a much later date of completion than the lower levels. Among the distinctive features of many cathedrals are elaborate carvings, sometimes of scenes from Jesus' life, sometimes of the saints and martyrs of the church. Built when England was still a Catholic country, with no inhibitions about iconography, they're often accompanied by gargoyles, grotesque figures of devils, but also angels. Nearly everyone was illiterate then, so the statues and pictorial windows had a didactic function, illustrating for ordinary folk the stories on which their faith was founded. They were perhaps particularly necessary since the liturgy was all said or sung in Latin. To add to the sensory vividness, the interiors of the cathedrals were painted, often brightly. Only after the Reformation in the 1530s were the walls stripped of paint or whitewashed over. In some of the cathedrals, many of the best statues were smashed or disfigured by militant Protestants who thought they were idolatrous. To get a sense of how their interiors might have looked before this transformation, you need to visit the great Catholic cathedrals of France, Spain, and Italy. Westminster Abbey, right across the road from the Houses of Parliament in London, is probably the most celebrated of all the Gothic cathedrals. Every monarch has been crowned there since 1066. 17 of them are buried there too, and it's been the site of 16 royal weddings. In its present form, it was begun in the middle 1200s on the site of an older monastery and was consecrated in 1269. At the east end, behind the high altar, is the exquisite Henry VII Chapel, whose ceiling exhibits one of the most perfect examples of fan vaulting among the last great achievements of Gothic architecture. The chapel was consecrated in 1516, shortly before the Reformation. The tomb of Henry VII itself, centrepiece of the chapel, was carved by an Italian sculptor, Pietro Torrigiano, who was a superb craftsman. Torrigiano is best remembered not for his sculptures, but for an assault on Michelangelo in Florence, possibly provoked by jealousy. Giorgio Vasari, in his Lives of the Artists, describes it like this. Torrigiano, having formed an intimacy with Michelangelo, and becoming envious of his distinction in art, one day, when jeering our artist, struck him so violent a blow in the face that his nose was broken and crushed in a manner from which it could never be recovered, so that he was marked for life. Whereupon Torrigiano was banished from Florence. Benvenuto Cellini, the era's greatest silversmith, recalls in his wonderful autobiography that he was invited to accompany Torrigiano on a trip to England, but was so horrified by this attack that he declined to go. Whatever his shortcomings as a gentleman, however, Torrigiano was a brilliant sculptor, and his statue on Henry's tomb stands among his masterpieces. Westminster Abbey is also famous for Poets' Corner, where many of Britain's most famous writers have been buried or commemorated. It's fun to read along the walls there and to single out the names, which include Geoffrey Chaucer, Edmund Spenser, John Dryden, Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, Robert Browning, Thomas Hardy, and Rudyard Kipling. Controversy often attends the placing of a new plaque, depending on the writer's status or conduct. Lord Byron was such a scandalous fellow in life, despite his great poetry, that he wasn't given a plaque until 1969, 145 years after his death. If, as many feminists believe, the 20th century poet Ted Hughes drove his poor wife Sylvia Plath to suicide, was it right that he should be honoured at Poets' Corner, right next to T.S. Eliot? Even Shakespeare, who's buried in Stratford-on-Avon, didn't get his plaque until 1741, 125 years after the fact. About 60 miles southeast of London is the cathedral city of Canterbury, the seat of the Archbishop, who's also primate of the worldwide Anglican Communion. Another dazzling Gothic structure, Canterbury Cathedral achieved notoriety in the year 1170 when Archbishop Thomas à Becket was murdered there. Becket, a thoroughly political man, had been chancellor to and a close friend of King Henry II. On becoming archbishop, however, he turned to asceticism and renounced his worldly loyalties, now standing up for the church's rights as against the king's. After an escalating series of conflicts, the king made an impatient declaration, variously remembered as, "Who will rid me of this troublesome priest?" or, "What miserable drones and traitors have I nourished and brought up in my household, who let their lord be treated with such shameful contempt by a low-born cleric?" Whatever the exact words, four of the king's knights entered the cathedral and hacked the archbishop to death, a violation of the tradition of sanctuary. A single candle burns today at the spot where his shrine was erected. 3 years later, Pope Alexander III named Becket a saint, and the scene of his martyrdom became one of the great pilgrimages of Europe. It's best commemorated in Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, written in the late 1300s, a series of stories told by pilgrims as they make their way from London to Canterbury, apparently not in a very pious frame of mind. If we travel to Staffordshire, in England's West Midlands, we'll find another lovely Gothic cathedral in the city of Lichfield. It's a distinctive structure. In fact, the only medieval cathedral with three spires. There's a famous and very atmospheric painting of it by Joseph Mallord Turner from the early 1830s. Architecturally accurate, but adding a glaze of romance and mystery to the surroundings. Building at Lichfield began in 1195 on the site of an older cathedral. It took about 135 years to complete, with stylistic adjustments along the way. Strongly pro-royalist in the Civil War of the 1640s, the cathedral was bombarded by parliamentary forces, lost nearly all its stained glass, and fell into partial ruin. The town itself changed hands repeatedly during the war. Only in the 19th century was it fully restored by confident builders who believed they could improve on the medieval original. The whole thing is immense and impressive, but it's also full of superb little things from every generation of its history. Last time I visited, it was hosting about 100 junior school children on an educational outing. The place was full of life and sending a timely reminder that cathedrals are meant to be places of community life, not museum pieces. In the chapter house, the place where the pre-Reformation monks would gather to discuss community affairs, is now kept a celebrated 8th century copy of the scriptures. Also displayed there is the Lichfield Angel, a carving fragment that was discovered during excavations in 2003. And probably dates from the year 672. It led to a great surge of interest in Lichfield and a spike in visitor numbers. A section of the old south wall still bears a fragment of the fresco paintings that once covered all the walls, but were whitewashed over at the Reformation or vandalised by parliamentary soldiers in the Civil War. The east window contains Flemish stained glass from the 1530s, not original to the cathedral, but instead brought in during the Napoleonic Wars from an abandoned monastery in Belgium. Countless statues and monuments give you plenty to admire at Lichfield, as in most of the cathedrals. Probably the best and most touching is the Sleeping Children, an 1817 statue by Francis Chantry, showing two sisters asleep in each other's arms. Both had died, one in a fire, the other of illness, soon after the premature death from tuberculosis of their father, a cathedral clergyman. The bereaved mother commissioned the statue. Chantry himself was among the most prominent sculptors of the Regency era, and in this work he made a moving statement about childhood that still speaks in a loud, clear voice. Other tombs, such as that of Henry Howard, another of the cathedral clergy, are also works of great brilliance and power. The man in charge of the Victorian restoration of Lichfield Cathedral was George Gilbert Scott, one of the big names of his era. Under his supervision, a superb wrought iron rood screen was installed at the entrance to the chancel. A rood screen marks off the nave from the chancel. Traditionally, they'd been made of carved wood or stone, so this was an innovation. At the same time, magnificent tiles were installed on the chancel and altar floors. It's often a good policy in English churches and cathedrals to look down. Decorative tiles were a specialty of the Victorians, nowhere better than here, except possibly in the Houses of Parliament. Some are copies of medieval fragments that the restorers found. Others are tributes to Queen Victoria and King Charles I. Together, they add to the richness and splendour of the ensemble. The south transept contains memorials to three renowned Lichfield natives: Dr. Samuel Johnson, the pioneer lexicographer, Erasmus Darwin, poet and physician, and David Garrick, the most famous actor in 18th century Britain. Most of this space is given over to military memorials, however, especially to members of the Staffordshire Regiment, who lost their lives in campaigns of the last 300 years. Battle flags, some thinned out almost to transparency, still hang proudly over the south entrance. A memorial book to men of the diocese who died in the First World War is on display, created and gilded with the same care as the illuminated manuscripts of the Middle Ages. 19th century regimental memorials often distinguish between officers, men, and non-commissioned officers, preserving gradations of rank and social class, even in death. Moving from Staffordshire to the county of Somerset in southwest England, we come to the city of Wells, nestled just below the lovely Mendip Hills. In Wells Cathedral, as in Lichfield, the structure is Early English, from the late 12th and early 13th centuries. But many of the details come from each of the subsequent centuries. There too, you soon realise that you're not beholding a once-and-for-all statement in stone, but a long process of people alive and at work, dying, commemorating each generation, and reshaping their surroundings according to new ideas. By the time you enter your third or fourth English cathedral, you're familiar with the basic shape and the relative position of nave, choir, pulpit, lectern, and altar. Now your eye seeks out interesting variations on the theme. Instantly notable at Wells is a great set of four strainer or scissor arches, installed in the late 1300s because the pillars supporting the crossing were sinking under the weight of the tower above them. An earthquake, very rare for England, had also weakened them, such that a super strong remedy was needed. These strainer or scissor arches may be functional, but they're also attractive, drawing your eye up to the triforium and giving the cathedral a distinctive badge all of its own. A long flight of worn stone steps leads up to the chapter house at Wells, and the chapter house itself is elegant and cool. All over Wells Cathedral, as at Lichfield, are grave markers and remembrances of the intervening centuries. A striking black wooden chest in one corner, shaped like a quarter circle, bears an explanatory card: "Cope chest, made of local oak, about 1120, and still in use." That's right, a 900-year-old chest still in daily use. A bronze lectern nearby carries this inscription: "Dr. Robert Creighton, upon his return from 15 years exile with our Sovereign Lord King Charles II, made Dean of Wells in the year 1660, gave this brazen desk with God's holy word thereon to the said cathedral church." That carries us 500 years forward from the making of the Cope chest, but still 400 back from our own times, to the fraught years of the Civil War, when a loyal clergyman might go into exile rather than submit to Cromwell's military dictatorship. A pair of grave markers in the cloisters tell a tale of their own, and by reading between the lines, you can imagine what actually happened. The first is to Robert Foster, a priest of the cathedral, who died in 1836. After paying tribute to his theological orthodoxy, the inscription continues: "His eyesight, weak from his birth, waxed more and more dim with advancing years, till at length those that look out of the windows were darkened. But a light sprang up in the darkness, while those around him shed the silent tear, contemplating his painful loss. A holy joy would brighten up his countenance, so that of him might it truly be said, he kissed the rod that smote him. Beside it is this tribute to his wife Joanna, who is praised for her humbleness of mind, benevolence of heart, placidity of temper, and untiring watchfulness. She's also remembered for anticipating the wants and alleviating the trials of a beloved husband when his sight had become darkened. Don't you get the feeling that he became increasingly cranky as he went blind and that she was infinitely long-suffering on his behalf? Next door to the cathedral is the bishop's palace, and at Wells you could be forgiven for thinking it was a fortress. It has crenellated walls and a moat and looks as though it could withstand a siege. The bishop in question, Ralph of Shrewsbury, a worldly 14th century builder, was resented by the local people for imposing taxes on them to get his ambitious projects completed. That's another worthwhile reminder that a lot of human vanity and an incredible expenditure were wrapped up in the making of the cathedrals. The last time this Wells drawbridge was used was in 1831, when riots broke out in nearby Bristol over the failure of Parliament to reform itself. Fearing the worst, the bishop sequestered himself inside until the situation calmed down. If the strainer arches make Wells distinctive, a 20th century statue of Jesus has the same effect at Llandaff, the cathedral for the Welsh city of Cardiff. Another beautiful medieval structure built in the 1100s, Llandaff Cathedral sustained repeated severe damage, first from Owen Glendower's rebellion in 1400, then from parliamentary troops in the Civil War, who turned part of it into a tavern and another part into a livestock barn, then from a severe storm in 1703, and then from the German Air Force in 1941. A rough-hewn stone marker placed where the bomb landed recalls the damage it did to the cathedral. Somehow, Llandaff is still there after these plunges into decay and the vigorous restorations that ensued. The Victorians got it back on its feet after years of neglect, with the Pre-Raphaelite artists Dante Gabriel Rossetti, Ford Madox Brown and Edward Burne Jones playing a prominent role, while funding came from the fabulously wealthy Marquis of Bute, Cardiff's greatest public benefactor. After the German air raid, the roof was rebuilt, and Jacob Epstein, a prominent sculptor, was commissioned to make the statue I mentioned a moment ago, a 16-foot-high rendering of Christ in Majesty, which stands atop a great concrete arch in the middle of the nave. It looks out of place to me, a defiantly 20th-century addition to an otherwise medieval building. On the other hand, it's much less bad than most 20th century church architecture in Britain. Llandaff has the usual regimental side chapel, in this case to the Welsh Regiment. Among its battle honours, recorded in the wall inscription, are those of the War of 1812, including battles at Detroit and Niagara that are scarcely acknowledged in American historical accounts. In the main body of the church is a superb recessed grave to Henry Thomas, a local judge. The sculptor has depicted Solomon, looking very much the Eastern potentate, judging the famous case of the baby between two women, suggesting it should be cut in half. That's just the right image for commemorating a good judge. There's also a full-size funerary statue of Sir David Matthew, right-hand man of King Edward IV during the Wars of the Roses, and a staunch supporter of the Yorkists against the Lancastrians. He's shown in full armour, and, as is common in such statues, his feet rest on a dog, the symbol of fidelity. The painted ceiling of the chancel is Victorian, and some of the stained glass was done by the Pre-Raphaelite artist Ford Madox Brown. The reredos, which is to say, the painting behind the altar, was done by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, another Pre-Raphaelite, that was now being removed to a side chapel near the west entrance. Here, as in so many of the cathedrals, the Victorians were all important. There was a great religious revival in the Victorian era. There was more money available than ever before. And there was a revival of interest in Britain's architectural heritage. The cathedrals, as we see them today, are far more impressive, well-kept, well-floored, and well-decorated than they were in 1800. I could easily rhapsodise at length about Lincoln, Ely, Winchester, Norwich, Salisbury, and many more of the medieval cathedrals. For those of you who'd like to pursue this